I'm Darius Larson. I'm campus pastor at St. Cloud State University, and up here I'm, they call it the village philosopher. Primarily it is trying to get you people to talk about topics that we all need to talk about. Tonight's title is Double Standards, Double Take in the Church. I spent about 4 or 5 minutes thinking of a few possible subgroups under that, and I came up with some that you can't probably read because of our marking pens here. But just to give you a little idea, then I want to share a couple examples, and then Mary Pellauer, who's on the teaching staff, will say some provocative, corny, was her two words, things about it as well. Double standards, double talk. I think we could zero in on any of the following. You could probably list many more. Clergy, lay, women, men, black, white, public ethic, private ethic, poor, rich, urban, rural, gay, straight, parish, specialized ministry, large parish, small parish, single, married, old, young, adult, child, and we could go on and on and on. I want to share two stories and then one concern, which I would hope that we could focus at least somewhat on tonight. I was right out of seminary, and it was about my second year, I guess, out of seminary. I was in a parish in Longmont, Colorado, and I happened to be buying at a liquor store some liquor. And somebody from behind me said, "Pastor, that's not communion wine you're buying." And all of a sudden, I mean, she was there buying too, right? All of a sudden, this cold sweat, I just remember it. Just, you know, like I was caught in the act of adultery or something even worse. You know, there I was. And person who knows choice words at that moment, I turned around and I said, "I know it isn't," and walked out. Another time, which is dealing with this public-private ethic, I think, was when I was with a group of pastors in San Francisco. None of them but myself was Lutheran, so that may not be appropriate here tonight, I don't know. But we were waiting to go in to the restaurant, and we're sitting at this bar, and the waiter asked, "What would you like?" And I ordered a drink, and everybody else ordered water, 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 water. And the interesting thing, I figured out afterwards, every one of those people had had a drink in my apartment when I was studying in the Bay Area. But none of them was going to order a drink in public. That's just two little autobiographical sketches there. The one, though, that I think disturbs me the most is the one that puts Herb Chilstrom in a really a tight bind. He, in Minnesota, as bishop of the Minnesota Synod, was an advocate, and is still an advocate for gays and lesbians in the Lutheran Church, and has been on the firing line all the time. And if those of you who have been reading the Lutheran or have received the pastoral letter by Bishop Chilstrom, what I could get out of that letter, it was concerning people at our seminary in Berkeley who are gay, who wish to be ordained. If I have the facts right here, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that the faculty said it was okay to go ahead with the ordination process. And so everything was going until there was some flack about this. Anybody stop me here if I have the facts wrong. And then Bishop Chilstrom and I think a couple other people said they wanted to meet with these candidates first before they proceed whether or not they want to put their names into call, place their names into call. And in my understanding right, if they would say that they would remain celibate, that they could be ordained. But if they could not make that statement, that they could not be could not be recommended for ordination. Is that basically right so far?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I don't know if I want to push it, but what it appears to me, and I've been an advocate of getting rid of double standards when we talk about gay and lesbian issues for a long time. And the problem I see is that do we ask that of single people to remain celibate? Not that I'm suggesting that we should. Do we ask it of married seminarians if they're going to remain faithful before call? And then there's this other issue. Do we ask that for church membership? Do we ask that of the laity? And what does that say to gays and lesbians that are not, that are lay people in the church as well? So that's one area of focus. And Mary, if you want to go with another direction or on the same direction, fine.
Well, I affirm that all the kinds of issues that Darius has put up on the board are ones that would be appropriate for us to talk about, but I want to take a slightly different tack. I mean, I want to take two tacks on this. One is to echo some of Darius' storytelling. Aside from my concern about issues like abuse and rape and other things in which double standards are rampant, I think that the first time I became aware of what was going on with relationship to issues of homosexuality and homophobia was in 1973 when I was teaching at a seminary in the Chicago area, and I was teaching a course on feminist theology, one of the early ones, and I had a group of about 20. And one night, my two best students in this class came to my room and said that they needed to discuss something with me. And what they told me was that they were two women who were deeply in love with each other, and they had been having a relationship for maybe a year, and that their relationship with each other was not widely known, but it had become somewhat known in the community, and that the person in the graduating class who had just been voted person most likely to succeed in ministry was blackmailing them about their homosexuality and extracting goods and emotional prestige and other kinds of things in exchange for not revealing to the seminary faculty that they were lesbians. And I remember just being quite torn about what kind of monstrosity we were creating in the church by rewarding the behavior of blackmail and disrewarding something quite extraneous about these two people who were really by far the two best students in that class. But in the last week, as we've talked about forums, we have had some concern about whether or not we could always find someone to argue against and for a particular topic. And so I think I just want to make one or two brief comments in favor of a double standard in order to sort of provoke us here this evening, because, well, just to be provocative. I want to make several comments about the usefulness of a double standard in American society in general and in the churches as a whole. One of them is that if we decide that there is a class, there are separate classes of people to whom different moral rules ought to apply, that does has several beneficial functions for the society as a whole. One of them is that it keeps the community divided against itself, so that some members of the community can be in control of other members of the community. And in a hierarchical society in which we're all concerned about getting out of control, especially about some issues like sexuality, it's very important to keep a double standard in place so we can all be reassured that in fact we're in control if we control this group out here. And second of all, if we have a double standard in place, this means that we can protect the hypocrisy of the great mass of us in the church who know perfectly well that perhaps clergy drink, perhaps good Christians drink or do things they're not supposed to do. But if we can all pretend by sort of focusing a certain standard of behavior on that class, if we can all pretend that somehow things are going well, our hypocrisy is very nicely protected. And thirdly, I want to say that if we have a double standard in place and things get really tough in society and we become aware that there are deep tensions and deep passions about these issues, if we have a group of people out there identified as somehow not fitting, that we always have prepared a group of people who are ready to be sacrificed on the path of order. And that if we can cast that group of people out, then the rest of us can be left in good order and secure, and everything will be fine. So I think double standards often are very effective and functional in the life of society and the church. They keep us from asking awkward, deep theological questions, which goodness knows we would not want to have happen. And they certainly allow us to maintain the hierarchies that the tradition has passed down to us in good working order. So,
what kept you out of the Reagan cabinet?
A knockdown argument.
Which one? That one?
Okay, I assume there were some things that are stirring in your consciousness. Yes?
I have a couple questions. First of all, what is the reasoning that Bishop Chilstrom and the others gave for their decision? And second of all, what has been the traditional position of the church since Christ through the last 2,000 years? I mean, has there been any consensus towards homosexuality, and what is that? And are we discussing possible changes from that, or what? I'm not even clear on that.
Okay. Would anybody like to?
I would like to make a stab at an answer to this. And it isn't. This is going to sound a little snippy, and I know your question is serious. The official policy of the church is, well, homosexuality was not a word until the 1860s and into the 1880s. So it's a little hard to know if we're always talking about the same thing down through the centuries of the church. The official policy has been often, to quote the lines of St. Paul or Leviticus, about certain kinds of unnatural behavior. And it's not clear that we know today what those unnatural behaviors amounted to. But the other part of the official policy of the church is that there were always homosexual people in the church. There were always homosexual people ordained in the church. There were always practicing homosexual people in the life of the church. And the official policy of the church, in a sense, was to ignore that fact. Now, I say that in a certain vein, I guess, of needing to be aware that when 10-15% of the population are people who are attracted to someone of the same sex, those persons have always been around, those persons have always been functioning. Some of those people, in fact, are among people who articulate strongly anti-homosexual policies in the life of the church for their own self-protection. And that's one of those areas, like my story about who is most likely to succeed in ministry blackmailing other people, there are deep levels of dishonesty that go on in all these discussions.
Might be worth mentioning Bosworth's book here too. Yale historian who did a lot of work on medieval attitudes and really worked the material and showed how complex the history is, how attitudes changed, how it's set within a cultural context. I remember in certain periods of where you have public homosexuality, yet it was under, you had certain standards of formal marriage because of the notion of the family. Homosexuals may marry, but your sexual life was somewhere else, and it, and he's begun to show what you can do with that. It's a very complex history. And so there has not, no, the policy has moved and has shifted from culture to culture. And I would say that there is a standard policy, it doesn't look like that.
Available in the bookstore, at least I saw it in there, is The Homosexual My Neighbor by Mellencott and
Skinzone.
Right. Yeah. It goes through the biblical stuff. I did a Bible study once here, and it's in the tape library too. Basically, very briefly, there's nothing in scriptures that can be stated to say anything against two people who love each other in a monogamous relationship, and they happen to be of the same sex. It's usually perverse value words. But different cultic prostitution in some cases, selling young bodies and those sorts of things, catamites, sodomites, that sort of thing. But nowhere does it say anything about two individuals who love each other and are of the same sex. It doesn't endorse it, it doesn't embrace it, but as far as the biblical text, it's silent on that.
I think it should be said that there's a difference of opinion among scholars at that point. That is entirely clear. I mean,
but biblically, you're talking about.
Biblically, that's right. You could pick up Leviticus scholars at that point and find quite contrary interpretations. So I couldn't state it's quite so baldly here. Maybe the second thing would be to say that there were, in the predecessor bodies of the ELCA, statements in this regard that I think, help me, that I think Chilstrom and the other bishops believe themselves to be acting in continuity with. Because I think that's not so. The new factor in the situation is that these persons have publicly declared themselves to be be homosexuals in a way that there has not been a prior history in the predecessor bodies. I think that's what has occasioned the new reality.
So the double standard is if you lie about it, if you don't tell anybody about it, then you can be ordained. But if you claim who you are, you're going to get in trouble, and we have to say no to ordained ministry in the Lutheran Church. So if you lie, or you claim to be celibate, then we will allow you.
You might even get by if you tell the right bishop, but not publicly.
Right.
I know mostly that LCA status.
Is not going public with something the same as lying?
No, I don't think it is, because up to this point it was never asked.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good point.
What do you feel is it for someone they feel they're living a lie?
There's a question. Barry had a concern, comment.
I guess I have more of a process comment. I think we've already sort of, I think it's real hard at this point in this forumist discussion, frankly, for somebody to make an argument that maybe there's good reasons for someone who's gay and lesbian not to be ordained. I think that it.
Okay.
I'm just trying to. I don't exactly know how to go with that, but I would like to allow that part of the conversation to emerge if it's here, and I'm not quite sure.
The only argument I can see is picking up from here is that if a homosexual.
Okay, can I finish just a second? I think that there's a way in which, I'm not quite sure, there's several different ways that you can look at double standard. And it seems like we're approaching the double standard right now as automatically a negative, dishonest thing. And I guess, and I'm not going to argue that it's not, But I guess I think that there have been a number of arguments about why the bishops would give that position, both in terms of both in terms of a theology of sexuality that would see some see gays and lesbians in a problematic position, as well as simply sort of a position of ecclesiology or the concern about the church itself, regardless of whether or not you stand, where you stand on the issue of gay and lesbians, a concern about whether the church is able at this particular point in its history to handle ordination of people. Now, I'm not going to argue those positions, but I think that we really need to maybe look at that and open that up into a little bit more in terms of what the double standard. I'm sorry.
Okay. No,
I was just going to say that the argument not to ordain would be for the homosexual himself because they don't care to live a lie. They don't want to have to closet themselves. And to their benefit, then, they don't get ordained. So they don't have to live a lie.
That's not the argument that the church isn't ready. I don't hear it that way. I mean, I hear the, and I think there is the case, and then the only defensible case is a kind of a claim that the church isn't ready for it. And I don't know who can speak that way.
Mm-hmm. Well,
homosexual, that kind of,
but
that,
the Duncan issue is often a way
that, that kind of argument about the church isn't ready for it really bothers me because that's the exact same argument that was used against women's ordination.
But I don't think that's the argument that's being made right now.
No, well, I mean, mentioned it.
Yeah, I guess what I'm maybe I should say one more thing. I guess I think that when you have, frankly, when you have this, at this point, you have a forum on double standards and you throw in gay and lesbian issues in it, that's going to be the topic of discussion for the most part.
I mean, talk about money.
You know, unless we shift it over. And I don't think you can really talk about that, I guess, as just simply an issue of double standards without allowing real discussion on the issue of homosexuality. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. I think ultimately, at this particular time in our history, that's what a discussion of double standards on ordination has to become, because those are the issues that most of us are still dealing with. I guess is maybe what I'm saying, is that it maybe that's where...
But no matter what issue we would take up there, that would be the same thing.
Yeah, but I think it's this was a little bit more packed, is what I'm saying. Yeah. And that's... So, with that said, I'll shut up.
What about money, Carol?
Oh, I just, you know, if you talk about the standards, the double or triple standards of salaries in the church are just incredible. You know, if you've got a large church and a big staff, the assumption is that you're worth a lot more money. And... small churches or women in churches get really low salary. Usually get the urban city jobs anyway, so that their rents are incredibly high. And they, you know, where is there any equity there? It seems to me the church ought to redo its entire system of salaries. And I think we'd get rid of a few prima donnas and we'd probably all be happier. I know that I'd get paid more and so would you.
Well, I was interested in your question because there has been this proposal of the uniformity of salaries for pastors as is done.
Some other system, not necessarily uniformity, but...
Well, something. I don't know what word you use, but as is done in Australia where all the pastors sort of receive the same salary.
Yeah,
something really delightful about that to me. But at the same time, it comes up against the issue why are people who work for the church expected to not make any money? This is sort of idea that we're supposed to be sacrificing servants and all, but a lot of people I know that work for the church give away lots of the money they make, but they like to be able to make enough to buy a home or, you know, what, same as everybody else. I think that's a double standard.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the feeling that you don't have to pay single people as much as you do, people who have.
Yeah, that's a big change in our society, though, because your major expense is housing. I live in Los Angeles. I can't afford to live close to my church. I mean, it's just the new apartments that are built right down the street start at $12.50 a month rent. Well, I mean, I'm not talking about $12.50 either. So that really is tough if you've only got one salary to pay for that. I'm not living there.
I'm a little confused right this moment, and what's going on in my mind here is how we started the focus, and then how I think Barry brought us around questioning that focus, so abruptly at least, you know, whether we moved too quickly there, and then how we quickly then jumped out of that focus into a different focus. Any of that could be okay wherever you want to go with it, but I'm going to say those are three different, if we want to keep challenging that original focus, go with that focus, or go with this focus, or a new focus. There's about three things going on here. So anybody want to say, let's do it this way?
Well, we might ask, if it really is a double standard, does the church say that homosexuality is okay? Is that the stand of the Lutheran Church?
Well, we cannot say anything right now about the stand of the church because we don't have one.
Have.
So it can't be a double standard, except as if there is no stand and they took a stand for pastors that they wouldn't take for you or I, then it is a double standard.
What we have is the pastor letter of a bishop in which the bishop said that the being of homosexual persons is okay. We've come that far in the last, so far. I mean, we're all recipients of God's unconditional love, but that the doing of homosexual acts is not okay. Therefore, the discussion about whether or not the three candidates certified for ordination would agree to refrain from doing any homosexual acts, although their homosexual being was good.
Right, I got all that.
So that's, I think, what the double standard part is about. It's maybe about the cleft between being and doing.
So I write to the bishop and I asked him, is it okay if I don't want to be ordained and I want to be a lay minister, can you put the laying of the hands on me? What would be... what then? Our commission. What do you think?
My sense is that most people in the church would say whether you are lay or ordained, it is still wrong. Mm. I think a lot of people in the church would say that even the being of homosexual, being a homosexual in itself is questionable. What I'm trying to say is that I'm not sure that this is an issue of a double standard for most people between being ordained or not ordained. I think it's the issue of whether homosexual acts are moral or immoral. Right. It would be the same thing as saying if someone was going to be ordained and was a kleptomaniac. I mean,
how I thought I laid it all out. It wasn't going to get into, now we can get into the rightness or wrongness of homosexuality. But what I thought was the double standard of Chostrom's letter is why are we singling out this issue when there are other things that seminarians do, which I would say most of us would agree on is equally bad or questionable, that we're not asking them whether or not they will be ordained or not. You know, are you single and celibate? Or are you acting out a heterosexual lifestyle, which means sexual activity? You know, we're not asking that. Now, the danger with that is, therefore, should we push that so far that we start asking that, and then where do we go? And then we really...
You've got all the other things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Where do we draw the line on all of that?
And it's a, promised to honor your father and mother. And
yeah.
No, that's a good point.
Yeah, so that's the point, what I thought I originally laid out, and not this other. So.
Just for clarification, yeah. It should be noticed that no single person has been asked any such questions in the Lutheran Church yet, because the approval process has not been in place.
No heterosexual single person.
Except for those three people.
Except, well, these three people have been, but there's the approval process, the candidacy process for the synods has not been put into place yet. Finally, that really occurs this coming fall.
You know, they used to ask if we promised, we swore that we had read the Bible at seminary. And I know guys that lied.
I think one was Carol.
No, I didn't.
It's quite possible, who knows, it's quite possible that such questions may get asked this year.
Mm-hmm.
I think some committees may in fact do that to be consistent on the matter. Just I've heard the word around in some.
Is there a question over here or something? I was just, for the sake of argument, what would be wrong with asking those questions? Asking all single people.
Oh, Mary, too.
How about Mary?
No, wait, let me finish. All single people remain celibate and all married people remain faithful. I mean, would that not cut a double standard? What would be wrong with
that? That would help this.
I mean, based on the heterosexual problem we have among the clergy, that might not be a bad question to ask. I mean, we're not doing real well.
But we come right back to this really sticky area called if you're single when you get out of seminary and you're going to be dating, then I mean, boy, it sounds like we're going right back to you can hold hands on your first date. I mean, I think the whole thing comes down to we really don't know what to do with our sexuality. I mean, it's like, what in the world is the church teaching about that, and how do you be in that particularly late adolescent and young adult phase of dating and trying to test out relationships and still remain faithful.
And just, of course, to complicate it more, we don't ask married persons whether or not they're abusive.
Yeah.
We get concerned about whether or not they might have a caring, sexual, non-violent relationship outside of the system. But we never ever ask them if they beat their wives or children, or husbands and children, or if they abuse, if they use sexuality as a weapon in some way inside the approved terms.
Well, the problem with it is that there's no stopping the questions.
That's fine.
You continue to ask more and more and more.
My question is, what is the purpose of the question? Is it to weed out the sinners? And then, do we go further and ask the lay people in our church? Maybe we shouldn't let people be members of our church.
There's a question or a comment back here. Did you have one? Yeah. Oh, okay.
Well, I mean, if they're going to weed out sinners, I guess I would be the first to go, right?
Yep.
I mean,
isn't
this sort of good Lutheran theology that we would all have to raise
But is
our
it
hand
to be judgmental, or is it to be helpful, or is it to, you know, do you then offer some sort of counseling?
If I understood what Barry was saying, though, you could make a case for at least the difference between clergy and laity. I don't know. I'm not comfortable with that.
Oh, I wasn't arguing.
I know, but no. But you say you could make the
most furthest to the left on that one.
Okay.
You want to get me started? I want to make clear I wasn't arguing.
Okay. Well, I misheard you there too.
but that's an easy case to make. I mean, the clergy are people we pull out and hold up before the church.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
I won't say it's not a problem, but that's the way the system works. Mm-hmm. Right. And isn't that part of the job definition? Kind of pedestal model again going on here.
I feel really uncomfortable even talking about this without a homosexual or lesbian person.
Well, we don't know.
Or speaking,
I know.
But I wanted to say, and I think the whole thing is really fascinating because we missed your first question back here. The answer, why did Chilstrom say what he did?
Okay.
And my sense of it is there's a lot of contingent factors going on, and what's really at stake is nobody wants to give reasons in this argument. To assume this is an argument where we put reasons on the table and arguments and we evaluate their cogency and their coherence is not the way it's working. And there are days when I think Chilstrom did the right thing by not letting it blow up. He bought some space to do, to get some, to see what happened and to find out what the mind of the church is, if you want to talk that language. But I'm not sure, having bought some space, the church wants to come around even at this point and has any procedures to figure out where it stands on these things. And how do you then work these things through? I think we're working in our modern bureaucratic model that if we can only get the procedures straight, we'll deal with all the problems. And from what I've seen of academic hiring over the last 10 years, the more you get the procedure straight, the worse it gets.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, if you lay out all these type procedures and you get 200, 300 resumes, and six people have to read them supposedly on the committee, obviously, it's where you know to stop and pause over something they get looked at. So I'm not sure, I don't want to, if we're talking, I guess I'm saying, if we're talking ourselves into the way around the double standard is rational procedures, I'm not convinced that's the answer.
Well, what I was hearing is either if we ask it of, I mean, some people were naughty when this was said, that if we ask it of gays and lesbians, we should ask similar types of questions to other people. And what are those questions? Which could be interesting. And if we aren't willing to do that, why should we be able, why ought we ask it of the gays and lesbians? And I would ask if any of you have answers to either of those sides. Let's not ask that question, will you remain celibate or not active?
I think a related experience secondhand about a meeting in Sacramento with Bishop Miller over Jeffrey and some 40 concerned clergy. The assistant to the bishop mentioned that next year this question would be asked of all candidates. And the question received a resounding hail of laughter as though it was a regression. Mm-hmm. Question is really immaterial.
You mean the question of celibacy?
Yeah.
For single?
Single.
Straight or gay?
Straight or gay. It's like the cows out of the barn. Just shut the gate now, right?
Is that a valid question, some of you who maybe have, is that a valid question to ask somebody before they're ordained, you think?
I have no reason, but it abhors, I really abhor a question like that. I don't know why, but it seems to be intrusive on my relationship with my God and all other sinners other than
over here and then over here. Yeah.
Well, if you ask that question, you're setting up a situation in which a certain number of persons are going to be liars. Mm-hmm. And I don't see the rationale for that.
It's kind of like my eighth grade confirmation class, that the kids who chose not to be confirmed are the ones I really wanted to confirm. Because they were taking this stuff seriously! You know, and all these other ones, they wanted that motorcycle these other wonderful bribes that parents give their kids to stick it out. And they don't give a darn about the faith. I mean, some of them didn't. And these kids said, I don't think I'm ready. You know, I want to think about this a little bit longer.
Yeah. I have a question to ask of David or anybody else that may know something about the word. But it seems to me that I've been reading recently, especially in Catholic literature, the use of the word celibacy to mean not refraining from sexual intercourse or relationships, but rather
to remain unmarried, which I think, I mean, that blows me away. It never occurred to me that it would be. You know what it means?
Well, of course, that is very much what the medieval practice was.
Yes.
One could be celibate and have one or more concubines.
Yeah.
And children.
But anyway, I see that kind of coming back into play, that there's there we are again sort of being pharisaical, saying, well, as long as you don't have a marriage performed, then you can do anything you want to. But I really think that here's where it is, that we need to talk seriously. I think that it'd be terrible to ask every single person, do you promise to be celibate? I think it might be wise to be talking seriously about what it means to live sexually responsible lives.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a whole different matter. It's not a request and a requirement of a vow.
How responsible will you be in your life?
Yeah.
All its fullness, including the sexual part of it.
And the seminary that I go to, there is a course that we're required to take. It's a seminar kind of thing, and at some point you're supposed to take it. And it's on sexuality and sexual behavior or sexual ethics. I think it's sexual ethics. And I think that's a more appropriate way of handling it. Like Mary was saying, is that we need to get a Mary or Carol?
No, Carol.
Carol. Okay. Is to get a handle on what our sexuality is, what is appropriate behavior, and what are we comfortable with. I think that's a more appropriate way of handling those kind of issues, rather than zapping somebody with a inquisition, just when you you're at the point of ordination, and then all of a sudden you hit somebody with this stuff. But if you deal with it earlier and deal with some of the questions of sexual identity and sexual behavior and ethics.
Well, I see the double standard in this, and the fact that, you know, we're willing to clobber somebody like that and prevent them from being ordained. What about the participation in all the oppression that's going on around the world? It's always the sexual sin that is raised up, and where people get killed for that. And all the killing that we do in our name. You know, no pastors ever ask, are you going to stand, you know, behind this or whatever. To me, that's a far grosser thing.
I can give you my most favorite Martin Marty quote during the Nebraska Synod Convention. Once he started his talk out, he says, 15,000 people are starving to death each year. We don't give a shit. And then he says, now the problem is most of you are more upset with the fact that I use the word shit than that 15,000 people are starving to death. And then he went on talking about that and why and all that sort of stuff. And it's true, you know, Marty said that. And I can only dare say it because I know Martin Marty said it, so I can never own it for myself. I have to tell you who said it.
I just want to say the same way. The Metropolitan Boston Association of the United Church of Christ, which is a church I'm a member of, the Committee on Ministry, which is a committee that reviews and essentially approves candidates for ordination, has just now passed another dimension of that process by which all candidates for ordination have to demonstrate some involvement and commitment to justice issues while they are either during their in-care process, which is at least a year and usually the whole time of seminary. So they have to, it doesn't mean that people are going to be involved in very different ways and different gifts for that, but in some way they have had to, and their field education, in other words, cannot just simply be going to a church and doing sort of traditional education and preaching. They also have to have done some work in some social organization or some justice or peace work in the church.
What if they do that with their lover who is of the same sex?
Well, the UCC does openly ordains openly gay and lesbian people. Now that's not perfect, and there's cases where that's really been problematic. It's a different structure. It's more decentralized, so you have some there are, I mean, I have, sounds like I'm going to say some of my best friends are gay. I have friends who are ordained UCC pastors who are openly gay and lesbian people.
I think though you can lie about that too, if you want to remind ourselves.
Sure, I'm just saying.
I can bring in my check stubs or something where I supposedly made some donations, and that's my justice ministry. Or, you know, if I work for some right-winger up in New Hampshire, is that justice ministry? Because that's, I really am committed to free enterprise.
And it becomes
cutthroat capitalism.
The second part of this, it becomes double talk. You know, what is justice? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, what is responsible sexual behavior? You know, we can say, we want quality education. You know, everybody can define that whatever way they want and say, you know, I am a responsible sexual human being.
Well, but at least there'd be conversation, Darius. It seems to me that there really is a difference between, say, sexual abusive behavior, and some sexually responsible behavior, it seems to me that to open the conversation instead of just having these fixed categories would be helpful mm-hmm. and healthy.
Yes.
Well, I work with a group called PFLAG, Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, and we have a support group that I kind of facilitate, I guess, for parents of persons who have AIDS. And I think the church fails to realize the dimensions of the issue. Just in terms of the 1 in 10 of the American population, male population, is gay, predominantly gay, and the 1 in 20 of the female population is predominantly lesbian. But that 1 out of every 3 to 4 American families has an immediate member who's predominantly homosexual. And the urgency of the Holocaust itself. And the way in which that is impacting not only that community and not only its desperate needs for ministries of a rather particular kind, but also the way in which it is influencing those families who either live in grief or else live in fear. And yet it is the subject that the church is very quick to say, you know, well, two messages. Number one, we won't accept the person. And number two, we really don't want to talk about it. So that the net result for the message that the parent of a dying gay man gets is go someplace else if you expect any kind of support or compassion. And that's the very clear message. And for goodness sakes, they're not going to ordain anybody like your kid. And so they will see the church almost entirely in terms of anger. And I guess, you know, what concerns me is we're not talking about some very small, tiny little percentage of few people that live in San Francisco or downtown Brooklyn. We're talking about a substantial world that exists alongside the world which we presume to be straight. And in Montana, where I became involved in this through some local churches who were trying to minister to a community there. I mean, the minute you start touching the surface of this population, not only of the gay and lesbian population, but also of that family system and the friend system and the brothers and the sisters, you're touching a whole world that exists alongside and yet does not emerge. And that, I think the world is the longer we go on with these conversations and the more open these conversations become in every other arena of our society and the more they become, closeted within the church, that world is going to leave us. So I think it fundamentally relates much more to just the tactical question of do we or do not we not ordain somebody who's doing this or that. But how do we maintain some integrity of the evangelical witness in the context of a rather substantial movement on behalf of a fairly large population of our culture?
Who didn't choose to be that way? I mean, that's the thing.
Well, neither they nor their parents or their families or their loved ones.
Yeah.
And when you minister to a person with AIDS, and you find this vast community of persons who are involved in ministry to a given individual, you will, as a Lutheran pastor, you take a lot of scorn, because they have very good reasons to be very angry. I mean, I think the issue is just much vaster, and I think it relates to, you know, how do we understand sexuality? How do we understand a world that lives right within our neighborhoods, and yet we choose not to see?
And what we fear is the symbol, no matter how we view that symbol, of choosing not to ordain those three people.
Yeah.
That is symbolic of a heck of a lot. And you can say, all right, we're finally getting back on track, or, oh no, you know.
Most of our Lutheran laypersons, technical congregation members, do not know that the extent of the debate or discussion, but virtually everybody in PFLAG does.
Yeah.
They're watching very closely what takes place in the Methodist Church, UCC, Catholic Lutheran churches.
So what do you think should take place in, let's say, the Lutheran Church, for example, on this issue? If Herb Chostrom or your local bishop gave you a call and just said, you know, this is a dilemma, you know, what advice would you give me? I need some help sorting this out. What might you want to say to those people who might be able to influence the church through your influencing them?
I say go back to the Bible, because I'm not saying that what you said was right about somebody said that homosexuality really wasn't defined as what most people believed it. I think we get too caught up in our materialistic world and we fail to get back to the Bible, to what it says. I know there are different interpretations, but that's a basis. And so I think we should go back there.
Actually, that's a wonderful answer, because that actually is what most of my lesbian friends say.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If we took the New Testament seriously when we're talking about the church, we would be saying to the rich young man to sell all that he has and leave his family and follow. That's a much more important criterion in Jesus' mind.
And also love. We're supposed to have love for everything, everybody. And if we're having these disagreements and this tension, that's not Christian either. And so that's another double standard, you know. We're supposed to have love, and yet anger, fear, hatred, whatever.
Oh, we're doing this, Ahava. Yeah.
Herb called me, I'd say, don't approach it from the point of sin. Approach it from the cross, from Christ's resurrection.
And Herb would say, what do you mean by that?
Well, basically, Herb, remember back in Systematics 102. I think that if we approach it from the point of sin, we've already alienated everybody. But if we pick the standard of Christ's death and move from that point, then then we aren't necessarily alienating the people. It was Christ's death that made us one community. It was Christ's death that it gives us the opportunity to be Christians, to be loved and in love with God. And so I would have that point rather than trying to strike camps between right and wrong.
If Bishop Chilton was to talk to me, I would say that he should treat ordinance the same way that I have had to deal with my daughter. I would either deny a reality, I would say she is sinful, or I would affirm a lesbian relationship. And I would like to see the church have the same standard towards its clergy that I would like to have it stand towards me. I have been able to affirm, I do not understand. Mm-hmm. And if not, it puts me in a very uncomfortable position in dealing with my church.
Yeah. I think we should define candidates for ministry in terms of some vision of what ministry could be for the church. In other words, what do we as a church want to do in ministry? And set it in terms of that population or that world to whom that ministry is addressed.
There are many parts of the body.
I was trying to refrain from saying anything else, but what you just said taps into. I guess I don't want to leave here without saying something about the clergy. Laity thing. And I guess the way I would respond to the question you're talking about and picking up on what Ellen just saying, this doesn't address the issue of how the church deals with sexuality, but in terms of this double standard stuff, I really think that the church ought to really consider what ordination is. And I don't have any problem with the idea that we need leadership in the church, and I make a distinction between leadership and authority. I will say that to start with. But I think we need leadership, and I think there's certainly a legitimate place of considering certain character, moral character, and certain kinds of leadership qualities in those leaders. But I don't think that that's what we do with ordination. Ordination is a separate category of being. It really is. I mean, that's the way that we approach it. And I haven't attained that level yet.
There's a New Yorker cartoon once to say, bathrooms in a cathedral is male, female clergy.
The Lutheran church will know that 6 years.
Well, I know that there's the fact that some people here earlier that were on the mission.
There are urinals in the thing that says clergy.
But I guess what I'm
saying... The door wasn't open. Excuse me. Yes. Excuse me.
It's these clergy, see? These two here won't even let a lay person talk. No, anyway. I guess... What gets really packed around issues of the criteria for ordination is that we really do start judging the being of that person instead of judging their competence for a job of leadership in the church. And I think that's really what ordination should be. Is a sense, it's a functional process in the church. It should be a matter of people who are qualified as we would use criteria for other people and other jobs to perform a certain function of leadership in the church. But we raise that way beyond that point. So there's a certain level of spirituality, a certain level of divineness or whatever. I'm not trying to say that everyone buys into that, but that's generally the perception.